Ground Zero Radio. This is Democracy Now!, an exclusive, the first juror to speak out on the overturning of the convictions of three white police officers for obstructing a grand jury investigation into the Abner Louima torture case.
These were policemen. They knew the legal process. They knew that as soon as the feds got involved, they know where a federal investigation leads to. It leads to a grand jury and then perhaps a trial. They were certainly, when they were planning to mislead the Brooklyn investigators and the federal investigators, they weren't figuring, oh, we'll mislead these guys, but hey, if it goes to a grand jury, we'll stop there. We'll respect the federal grand jury. No, they were planning to mislead everybody.
All that and more coming up. Welcome to Democracy Now! I'm Amy Goodman. In a diplomatic blitz, the United States won approval for a UN Security Council resolution that endorsed the idea of a Palestinian state for the first time and demanded an immediate ceasefire in the escalating Mideast conflict. The U.S. surprised the Council by introducing the resolution Tuesday after years of blocking measures it considered biased against its close ally Israel. Diplomats said the timing of the resolution was important, with Vice President Dick Cheney in the region. He's there to garner support for a possible attack on Iraq. Meanwhile, UN Secretary General Kofi Annan harshly criticized Israel yesterday, calling on it to halt attacks on Palestinian civilians and end its illegal occupation of Palestinian lands. Aid said it was the first time the UN chief had branded the occupation as illegal. Annan's emotional plea before the UN Security Council came as Israeli ground forces and helicopter gunships killed more than 30 Palestinians in their fiercest assault on the occupied territories since Israel moved into them in 1967. Israeli television said the offensive involved some 20,000 troops. No Israeli soldiers were reported killed. Six other Israelis died. A Washington Post report has revealed the U.S. has been secretly sending prisoners suspected of al-Qaeda connections to countries where torture during interrogation is legal. Bypassing normal extradition procedures, the U.S. has been moving prisoners to such countries as Egypt and Jordan, where they can be subjected to torture and threats to their families to extract information. The information is then passed on to the CIA, which has close ties with the local intelligence services. U.S. involvement in seizing so-called terrorism suspects in third countries and shipping them with few or no legal proceedings to other countries is not new. In recent years, U.S. agents working with Egyptian intelligence and local authorities in Africa, Central Asia, and the Balkans have sent dozens of people to Cairo or taken them to the United States. This news from Zimbabwe. President Robert Mugabe has been declared the winner of Zimbabwe's long-anticipated presidential elections. His supporters are calling it a victory not only against the United States, but also against Western Europe. The results announced on state-owned radio showed a landslide victory for Mugabe. The race against the opposition leader presented Mugabe with his first real electoral challenge since he led Zimbabwe to independence 22 years ago. Morgan Tsvangirai, meanwhile, has condemned the results, saying the election was unfair. Independent observers have also questioned the validity of the vote, saying it was tainted by violence, intimidation, confusion, and disenfranchisement of thousands of voters in the opposition stronghold of the capital, Harare. Afghan and U.S. forces are declaring victory in the 12-day battle against Taliban and al-Qaeda troops in the mountains of eastern Afghanistan. The battle, which was bloody and vicious in its first days and inflicted the most serious casualties on the U.S. to date, ended this morning with comparatively little bloodshed and resistance. The U.S.-led coalition has said it's now in control of the region, but the New York Times is saying it's impossible to know at this time whether today's combat involved a shrewd victory or a clever getaway by Taliban and al-Qaeda fighters. Three Afghan commanders interviewed about the attack said many of the enemy had likely slipped away. Meanwhile, the Times of London is reporting hundreds of U.S. troops were pulled out of the recent ground battle with al-Qaeda forces because they failed to adapt to the guerrilla tactics required for fighting in the mountains. According to Afghans fighting alongside the U.S., more than 1,000 Afghan troops rushed to the front line on Monday to take up the slack after the withdrawal of 400 U.S. troops. The U.S. military has described the withdrawal as a tactical reappraisal of their battle plan. And racist attacks against Asian Americans spiked significantly nationwide after September 11th, claiming two lives and causing injuries to dozens more. This according to a report released by the National Asian Pacific American Legal Consortium. Finally, lawyers for people arrested for questioning in the so-called terrorism investigation are using a variety of legal tactics to try to chip away at the unprecedented secrecy surrounding the detentions. Although hundreds of detainees have been released since the attacks, the Justice Department says 326 people remain in custody in New Jersey jails. In the latest lawsuit filed, civil rights groups and three New Jersey publications are seeking a ban on secret court hearings for detainees.
Is this something for the time capsule? No, it ain't trying to make the Billboard chart. MTV, Rap City, Hot 97, the vibe or the source. This is intensely trying to tell you that this is a counterattack against the mass dumbing down of black culture. Rap, race, and reality and technology set you free.
This exception to the fool, I ain't proving no points. Ain't trying to sell you, we are gathered here. Hear me, this is called the lecture series. 1,001 reasons to fear me as I trek through the nation. Giving vibe sessions, massive conversations. Let the deaf, dumb, and blind see. Lecture series to set your mind free. Lessons on rap, race, and reality. Education makes you what you really be. All you choose to really be, communication. Rise on technology. Hit the fertile minds like Suskind. Rap, race, reality, technology. Drop the bomb. We got to drop the bomb. Come on. We got to drop the
bomb. Drop the bomb. Fine Arts Militia here on Democracy Now! Breaking the Sound Barrier with a Democracy Now! Exclusive. This week, former New York City police officer Charles Schwarz tried and failed to get a different federal judge assigned to his new trial than the torture attack of Haitian immigrant Abner Louima. This came just days after Schwarz was freed on $1 million bail after his conviction conspiring to obstruct a federal grand jury investigation was overturned on February 28th, the last day of Black History Month. A retrial of his initial conviction is scheduled for June. And aspects of his first trial were also overturned by the court. The appeals court also threw out the convictions of two other officers, Thomas Bruder and Thomas Weiss. The overturning of these sentences and the freeing of the officer have sparked outrage from civil rights organizations. With this decision, the only officer incarcerated for Louima's brutal torture and sodomy with a broken broomstick is former officer Justin Volpe. He was sentenced to 30 years in December of 1999. Police brutality has long been a regular occurrence in New York City, from the police strangling of Anthony Baez to the killing of Amadou Diallo in a hail of 41 police bullets. But the case of Abner Louima stood out for its horrific sexualized violence. On August 9, 1997, Louima was arrested outside a Brooklyn nightclub after a scuffle in which he was not a participant. He was handcuffed, thrown into a police car, where he was beaten severely en route to Brooklyn's 70th Precinct. There, he was brutally tortured. He was taken to the Station House bathroom, where Officer Justin Volpe rammed a broken broomstick into Louima's rectum, while Schwarz allegedly held him down. Two other officers, Bruder and Weiss, were eventually convicted of obstructing the federal grand jury investigation, along with Charles Schwarz. When Louima's attack at the hands of New York police officers became public, it was impossible for even the most zealous NYPD defenders to justify Louima's treatment, although some tried. Justin Volpe's lawyer, Marvin Kornberg, desperately suggested before the trial that it would be proven that Louima's injuries were the result of rough gay sex. Now all but one of the convicted officers is free. Today, for the first time since the overturning of the convictions of the three officers in the conspiracy case by a federal Federal Appeals Court, a juror is speaking out in a Democracy Now! Exclusive. The juror has asked that we not reveal his identity for fear of reprisal from supporters of Charles Schwarz. Late last week, this juror came into our Firehouse studios where he spoke about the overturning of the verdict that he and 11 other jurors handed down. This is what he had to say.
The charge was conspiracy to obstruct and mislead a federal grand jury investigation. And it was quite specific about that. And that's important now because of what the Court of Appeals has done, because they've overturned the verdict on that basis that it was they felt that there was insufficient evidence for a conspiracy to obstruct a federal grand jury. And what's ironic is that the issue of the federal grand jury being obstructed, as opposed to merely misleading various investigators, came up in the trial, in the presentation of the evidence, and the cross-examination. It came up extensively in the judge's instructions to the jury, and it came up in the jury deliberations itself. So it seems really weird to this juror that the court could overturn it on that basis.
What was your reaction when you heard about the overturning of the convictions that you all voted unanimously for?
Well, I had two reactions. One, you know, they overturned elements of the first trial as well. They overturned the conviction of Schwarz on the first trial. And there, as a, in general, I couldn't really object too much to what they did because I didn't know the facts of the first trial. I wasn't a juror on that trial. And one thing I did learn is that as a juror, when you're in a trial, there's a lot more than what people outside of the trial, even who read the newspaper every day, etc., might know. So I kind of withhold judgment a bit about the overturning of the first trial. But the second trial was total dismay because they did not, the Court of Appeals did not find any evidence of jury misconduct, of judicial error. There was no error on the part of Nickerson. There was no problem with the proceedings. They didn't even disagree factually with the finding that there was a conspiracy to mislead investigators. They just felt that the facts did not warrant a verdict of guilty on misleading a federal grand jury, conspiring to mislead a federal grand jury. And that's totally absurd because these were policemen. They knew the legal process. They knew that as soon as the feds got involved, they know where a federal investigation leads to. It leads to a grand jury and then perhaps a trial. They were certainly, when they were planning to mislead the Brooklyn investigators and the federal investigators, they weren't figuring, oh, we'll mislead these guys, but hey, if it goes to a grand jury, we'll stop there. We'll respect the federal grand jury. No, they were planning to mislead everybody at the state level, at the federal level, at every level.
So what do you think of the argument of the appeals judges?
Well, it's flawed. I'm dismayed. I'm dismayed that, you know, I mean, personally, I felt actually sympathetic in many respects to Bruder and Weiss. They hadn't been involved in the assault on Louima. Bruder had actually helped Louima after he'd been assaulted. He was the one who called the ambulance for Louima. In fact, if it hadn't been for Bruder, Louima might have died and there never would have been a trial and Volpe wouldn't be doing time. And Weiss is, I don't believe he's a racist. I mean, his personal life strongly suggests otherwise, but they did commit this crime and they never served a day in jail as far as I know. Mm-hmm. And now they're totally exonerated and the feds won't, the court won't let the feds retry them as far as I know. Perhaps they could be retried in Brooklyn.
You said they weren't guilty of the attack. What about this argument that has been put out there for a while now, this undercurrent that one of them possibly was involved with the attack and actually held Louima down as he was being tortured.
Oh,
by
well, that was Shores. Shores was involved in the attack. I distinguished between Bruder and Weiss.
Right,
and
but the
Shores.
Argument that possibly...
Yes, well, the argument, and this is the essence of their conspiracy, they wanted to throw smoke and, you know, dust in the eyes of the investigators, plant enough reasonable doubt, you know, in the record so that a jury wouldn't be able to find anybody other than Volpe guilty of anything. So they their story was that Weiss was the one who led Louima to the bathroom and was behind the door of the bathroom and occasionally went in. But you know, their story was careful to keep Weiss out of the bathroom during the period of the assault. You know, so they didn't want Weiss to actually end up really in the hot seat. But their goal was to keep Schwarz completely away from the bathroom during this time. And all the evidence points to Schwarz being in the bathroom, having been the one to take Louima to the bathroom, going in with him to the bathroom, being in the bathroom, and you know, and so these guys were lying.
Let's go back through the case. If you could walk the listeners, the viewers who can't see you, rest assured, the viewers through this case from the beginning, actually from when you were chosen to be a juror in this trial. When was it?
Well, it was a long process. We were first called to fill out a huge questionnaire. About 600 people were called to fill out a huge questionnaire on January 3rd of 2000. And then we had to put all our plans in life on hold for a month and call up some number every day after 3 o'clock to find out if we were going to be voir dired, which means interviewed by the court. And then eventually I was voir dired and other people were. And then out of the group that were voir dired and seemed appropriate for jury duty, 75 were selected to come in one day, and they put numbers. We were all numbers. Nobody ever knew anybody's name. We were all numbers, and they put numbers into a spinner of sorts, you know, and pulled out numbers, and that was it. And they seated people on the jury stand, and then the lawyers for both sides, used their preemptive options and would kick out, you know, a few people, not many, and then they would pick some more numbers out of the hat, and they got their 18 jurors, 12. Regulars and 6 alternates.
Mm-hmm. And who was this jury that convicted all 3 men of conspiracy to mislead a grand jury?
It was a jury of geographical Long Island, of people from Brooklyn and Queens and Nassau and Suffolk, and there was men and women and black and white and Hispanic, and there were people with professional degrees and PhDs, and there were people who I don't think finished high school. And there was everybody in between, and they were, you know, despite all their supposed differences, everybody really obeyed the judge's instructions, and we were not supposed to, for example, during the evidence part of the trial, discuss the case, and nobody did. There was no misconduct, and people took it all very, very seriously.
You weren't sequestered.
We were not sequestered. We would be picked up at ungodly hours in the morning by vans driven by U.S. Marshals, unmarked vans, and then we would be brought into the court, and then in the evening we would be brought home the same way. So we were not, you know, sequestered would have been torture, but
you said that
we were kept anonymous, and we were advised not to, we were told that we couldn't tell anybody about, you know, our participation, you know, other than our immediate families.
And you only knew the other jurors by numbers.
That's right.
Never knew their names.
That's correct.
Couldn't contact them today?
Well, now we could. We were actually, in fact, we could be public now, but, you know, spending all that time being anonymous makes you kind of feel like you ought to stay anonymous. So it was, that was the situation.
And you are listening to a Democracy Now! Exclusive, as Democracy Now! Brings you the voice of the first Louima juror to speak out since the Federal Appeals Court overturned the convictions of the three officers, Thomas Weiss, Thomas Bruder, and Charles Schwartz, and the obstruction of a grand jury investigation case. When we come back, he'll talk about the content of their deliberations. You are listening to Democracy Now! We'll be back in a minute.
Count the bubbles of spit after the belt squeezed around Raynard's neck. Count the nuts in the pecan tree that screamed to show the world how hatred recycles itself repeatedly by killing black babies by letting them swing in Mississippi breezes. Once you count the bubbles of spit and the screams from the nuts in the tree, then look a conscious black person in the eye and ask for an apology. Has Mississippi apologized for slavery, sharecropping, and denial of education and basic human and citizens' rights? Has Mississippi ever apologized for the legalized lynchings of the White Citizens Council, who laid the foundation for recycling of hate? Is not an apology the admittance of some wrongdoing and an attempt to make amends? Should not Mississippi and the rest of the colonized world be apologizing to the heart and soul and mind of black women and men?
An Apology at the End of a Rope in Mississippi by Jolivet Anderson. You're listening to Democracy Now! I'm Amy Goodman as we bring you this exclusive an interview with the first juror to speak out on the overturning of the convictions in the Abner Louima conspiracy case. In just a moment, we'll hear from this juror about the role of fired New York police officer Anthony Abadi, a close friend of Charles Schwartz. Abadi was fired from the department in 1996 for verbally abusing a female officer during an argument and then lying about it under oath. When she testified again at the Louima trial, Abadi was accused of intimidating her again. This interview, which we're doing for community radio stations around the country as well as on public access TV, involved the juror coming into our firehouse studio. He did not want to be filmed, though he was willing to speak, and so he is shrouded in darkness as he talks about the overturning of the convictions.
Talk about how the case was laid out to you, how the prosecution presented the evidence, what was most convincing to you, and if at the time where you then started to deliberate, you felt that these three men, Bruder, Weiss, and Schwartz, were guilty of conspiracy of a cover-up.
Well, the prosecution laid out the case chronologically and started with testimony about the original altercation in front of the Club Rendezvous in Brooklyn, where Louima was arrested along with several other people. And they proceeded through the, chronologically, which was probably a good idea, through the whole business up through the extensive phone calls that were made between the defendants and various other parties and their testimony to and giving evidence and the way they changed their story at certain times.
Do you remember that? Can you explain?
Yeah.
First of all, how much communication did they have was documented, and who were they talking to after Louima was tortured?
Well, one of the most important pieces of evidence that came out was that first of all, they could show phone calls, but they couldn't show, obviously they weren't recording these phone calls. They showed that Schwartz with Weiss on the morning that IAB came to the 7-0 and where it became clear that this was going to be an incident that was going to be under investigation, they stopped essentially their patrol activity and they went to a telephone, a public telephone, and called a former cop named Anthony Abadi. And he had been a cop who had been fired from the police force some time ago, prior to the assault on Louima, for all sorts of misconduct, and he had been a PBA representative, delegate or whatever, and it was they're, think of the situation. Okay, you know, it's hitting the fan right now in the 7-0. And what do you do? Well, you call this guy at 6 in the morning, okay, on a Sunday, I think it was. I think it was that. And what are you doing? You're calling him up to say, well, hi, how you doing? Or, you know, or gee, this is really terrible. I just thought you'd like to know that, you know, we're worried about what's going on in the 7-0. No, they were freaking out, and they wanted some advice as to how to deal with it. And thereafter, Schwarz, who had been good friends with Abadi and had made phone calls at a certain regularity over, you know, prior to that, but thereafter the phone calls between Schwarz and Abadi increased. But what was remarkable were the phone calls between Weiss and Abadi. Weiss had never been, had never made any phone calls to Abadi prior to that. And then all of a sudden, there were, you know, literally dozens and dozens of phone calls, and it was clear, you know, it was clear that Weiss wasn't going to Abadi for personal support. He was clearly not an old, you know, buddy of Weiss's. He was going to Abadi to get advice and perhaps get help in coordinating the conspiracy. In terms of the conspiracy, the most, to establish a conspiracy, you need to have at least one overt act, okay, by the group of defendants. You have to have evidence that the other defendants, even if they didn't commit the overt act, knew about the conspiracy and had given their agreement to its general goal. Okay, well, the guy who committed the overt act, I mean, in the most obvious way, was Bruder, because he gave one story on Friday to a police captain, I think, from IAB, Internal Affairs. But then later, on Tuesday, he gave a different story to I think it was the Brooklyn DA's office, and this was the same story, essentially, that he repeated to federal investigators, and, you know, this is what went to the federal grand jury. And this story, the story change, took place only after Weiss had been given substantial immunity from prosecution by the Brooklyn DA.
Explain how his story changed. What exactly did he say?
The idea is that in his original story, he didn't mention anything about anybody who was taking Luima to the bathroom. He didn't mention Schwarz, but he also didn't mention Weiss. He said, well, this is what he recollected, and he didn't know anything more. That was on Friday, and then all of a sudden on Tuesday, his memory became, you know, substantially better. He then all of a sudden recollected that it was Weiss who led Luima to the bathroom, and that Weiss was outside playing with a little dog, cleaning up after the dog had defecated. I mean, it was a, you know, he made up a whole story. We know this is false because there was some, you know, very, very substantial evidence presented in the trial that showed that it was Schwarz who took Luima from the front desk to the bathroom.
What was that evidence that convinced you?
It was, the papers, the media tend to make it all based on the testimony of one cop, Eric Turetsky, who was famous because he was the first one to break the blue wall of silence. But actually, it was a testimony of a good number of people. For example, the desk sergeant, Jeffrey Fallon, testified that Schwarz was at the front desk processing Luima, that it was Schwarz who moved the prisoner, Luima, away from the front desk and moved him from the front desk up to a room that they call the 124 room, which is opposite the staircase where Turetsky at that point was going up. There was another officer, Schofield, who was hanging around the front area of the precinct and who testified that he saw Schwarz move Luima past the 124 room up to the hallway that goes to the bathroom. Turetsky, going up the stairs at that point, had kind of turned or done a double take because Luima's pants were down and testified that he saw Schwarz take the prisoner to the hallway and then turn and then go past the door to the arresting cells. Now, past that door, there's only two places you can go. You can go to the lieutenant's locker room, which is unlikely, or you can go to the bathroom. So you have not just one cop, but you have three cops giving evidence that completely put Schwarz in charge of the prisoner. Furthermore, Louima himself, from the beginning, although he can never, understandably pick Schwarz out of a lineup of pictures or anything like that, out of a photo array, but Louima from the beginning consistently said that it was the driver who took him into the bathroom, who was in the bathroom with him. And we know there was somebody in the bathroom. We know that it wasn't Volpe alone, because Volpe, according to many, a lot of testimony, had dressed down. He'd removed his gun. He'd removed his radio. He'd taken a broom, broke it in half, and he was, in there just with his clothes and his stick in the bathroom. But Louima testified from the beginning, and that's important. I'll get into that in a moment. From the beginning, Louima testified that there was an officer with a radio in the bathroom, and that was not Volpe. So, what's important about Louima's testimony being consistent is that Louima's testimony had some flaws in it, not what I just mentioned, but some other testimony. He, for example, at one point talked about Giuliani time, and that turned out to be, a misguided suggestion, I guess, from some of his early handlers. But when he was in the prison, under arrest, in the hospital, at Coney Island Hospital, under arrest, it wasn't the Abner Louima case yet. He was some poor guy who had been just incredibly brutalized, and some cop comes in, some sergeant from IAB, to ask him some questions. And he wasn't famous. He was still under arrest. He was, as far as he knows, could know, in great danger. He wasn't making up stories. He was telling, what the heck had happened to him. And he said it was the driver who took him. So,
and the driver was Schwarz.
There was no question that there was somebody else in the bathroom with him. So even the hokey story that Bruder made up, with the obvious connivance and acceptance of the others, doesn't hold water, because Bruder's story keeps Weiss out of the bathroom for the most part. And, given what Volpe actually did to the prisoner, to Louima, you needed a second person to do that. Even handcuffed, it would be pretty hard to do what he did, given, the way a person would squirm and bend and, move about. So it was very clear that a second person was in the bathroom, and just tremendous testimony that the second person was Schwarz.
Mm-hmm. Now, Volpe ultimately was convicted of the crime in the first trial with Schwarz.
That's right.
You were a juror in the second trial around the issue of conspiracy to cover up what had taken place.
Right.
So you heard this whole story, then you heard about all of the phone calls that were made, you're saying, to this fired cop, Anthony Abadi.
Right.
Both from Weiss, calls to him from Weiss, and from Schwarz.
Right. But the key thing was, the calls from Schwarz to Abadi could have been said, well, you could explain that by, Abadi and Schwarz were friends, and that's an established fact. So Schwarz is in trouble. He could call Abadi, and, you couldn't say that it was necessarily conspiracy. But all of a sudden, Weiss is calling Abadi extensively. I think there were even some phone calls from Bruder to Abadi, but I think it was primarily Weiss.
And are you saying they were afraid to talk to each other, so they were speaking through Abadi?
I'm not sure. I don't know why they needed to continue with Abadi. I don't know if it was fear that their phone calls would be traced or something, but I think it was clear that from the beginning, their turning to Abadi meant that they were turning to obstruct justice, that they wanted to find a way out of this. How do we get out of this? And I mean, this was the thing that you didn't need the phone calls to Abadi to accept to find Bruder and Weiss guilty on the conspiracy charge. Ironically, although Schwarz was had done the worst misdeed of the three by far, on the charge of conspiracy, the evidence was much stronger for Bruder and Weiss, because Bruder was the one who committed the overt act. okay, that, I mean, most clearly committed the overt act. Okay, he changed his story in a totally unbelievable way. But think of what how he changed his story. He changed his story so that on Tuesday he implicated essentially another cop. He brought Weiss into the picture. And you know, the defense attorneys over and over again said, well, why would Weiss want to be in this picture? That's the worst place for a cop. No New York City cop would want to be anywhere placed anywhere near that bathroom on that date. So even though now Weiss had arranged to get immunity from prosecution, but even that is not, you know, I don't believe that a cop like Bruder or any cop would cops are reluctant to testify against each other even when the charge is true. Turetsky himself, it was very obvious from what happened, was reluctant. He didn't want to do this. It took him quite a bit to get it together to do that. So cops don't like to testify against each other, you know, when the charges are true. You can imagine how reluctant a cop would be to say something against another cop if it was false. Bruder would only do that, obviously, if Weiss acquiesced. And certainly there was, you know, many opportunities. They were on the phone to each other where they, you know, they could arrange to, you know, where Weiss could make it clear that it was okay, that this is what had to be done.
So Bruder and Weiss, there were many calls between them?
There were some calls.
What about meetings of these men and also these men with the PBA, with the Patrolman's Benevolent Association?
Yes, there was a famous meeting that they made much about in the trial on, I think, Wednesday morning with the PBA. And I think Volpe was there and Schwarz was there. They were all there.
And this was how close to the attack on Louima?
The attack was, I think, Saturday night. I don't have my notes in front of me, but it was Saturday night. And then Sunday night, the IAB came in. And so this was Wednesday after the Saturday. Mm-hmm. It was a few days after. But it had already gotten, the attention of the feds at that point. But, you know, they have a meeting. It's a PBA meeting. Nobody took, you know, there were not minutes. So that really didn't prove a lot of, you know, there was not really much evidence there from our point of view. And the huge numbers of phone calls, the extensive records that the FBI put together from Verizon, you know, was not especially helpful one way or the other. It seemed very clear that all of these people had ample opportunity to communicate. We didn't need the phone records to show that. Like, the phone records did show that. But on the other hand, the phone records didn't prove anything about what they said. But what counts is their actions. You see, the actions here speak louder than words. This was actually part of the judge's instructions to pay attention to and make inferences based on actions. You know, Bruder tells one story on Friday. Okay, Monday, Weiss gets, you know, substantial immunity. Tuesday, Bruder changes his story and puts Weiss in the picture. Gives what we know to be false testimony implicating a cop who he has nothing against. Okay, he would never have done that without Weiss's acquiescence. The only purpose in doing that could have been to exculpate Schwarz. So there you have it, an overt act and the agreement between two parties, namely Bruder and Weiss, in commission of this overt act for the purpose of confusing the feds and anybody else for that matter about Schwarz.
What was for you the most incriminating piece of evidence?
There wasn't any. It was, you know, there was no, you know, there was no smoking gun. I mean, if you see, for example, what was important for us, for me and for all of the jurors, was, first of all, before anything else, that we had to figure that Schwarz was in the bathroom. We were instructed that we didn't have to figure that, but we felt that if Schwarz wasn't in the bathroom, then we couldn't be sure that anybody was lying about what they were saying, you know. And if they weren't lying, then there was no overt act to mislead the investigation. And so, where could you go? So the first thing that we had to establish, even though this wasn't our direct charge, was to figure out whether Schwarz was in the bathroom. And you see, there wasn't one piece of evidence that put him in the bathroom. It was a multitude. So to say that Schwarz was not in the bathroom, you'd have to say, well, Louima, you know, was wrong.
You are listening to a juror speaking out for the first time after the federal court overturned the convictions of officers Thomas Bruder, Thomas Weiss, and Charles Schwartz for obstructing a grand jury investigation. He does not want to be identified for fear of, quote, unsavory characters in Officer Schwartz's support committee. We'll be back with him in just 30 seconds.
My man, I'm angry, and I'm all wound up, and I'm all tied down, balled up inside and spinning all around.
You are listening to Democracy Now! As we break the sound barrier with a juror in the Abner Louima conspiracy case. I'm Amy Goodman.
So after all of the evidence was presented, you went to deliberate.
And that's right.
What was the feeling at first when the jurors went in and had a conversation for the first time about the evidence?
It was weird because, you see, we weren't allowed to talk about the evidence beforehand. We could talk about anything except the trial. So this it was all of a sudden talking about stuff that had been, you know, taboo up to that point, and nobody knew how to start. And so one guy wanted to have a straw vote, you know. I guess everybody had seen 12 Angry Men. So actually the straw vote, everybody would have been, if the straw vote had been based on a majority vote, everybody would have been acquitted. Hmm. And then we started talking, and, you know, I think there was an emotional sense that, well, Schwartz, most people were very convinced that Schwartz was in the bathroom, but not everybody. We had to work on that. And most people felt that because Schwartz was in the bathroom, he was in some way the most obvious guilty member of the conspiracy. But then when we reflected, you know, we had to remind ourselves that we were being, given the charge to determine guilt on the conspiracy charge, not on whether Schwartz was in the bathroom. We could use that fact or not in our deliberations, but that wasn't, you know, what we had to figure out. So, we first worked on that fact, on Schwartz being in the bathroom, and then, you know, we kind of went back and forth from one one of the perps to the other and defendants. And I think we first, you know, because it was more obvious in the case of Bruder and Weiss, we first found them guilty. But that took a long time. And we started from scratch. And we, it was a good bunch of people. I mean, people listened to each other. It wasn't one of these horror stories that you hear about in juries.
But you know, you first, when you took that straw vote, you voted to acquit.
I don't even remember how I voted, but in the beginning, I was actually in favor of acquitting Schwartz, and that was based on, you know, on the you know, evidence.
Acquitting him of being,
conspiracy, of uh-huh. being in the conspiracy. Mm-hmm. And,
what changed for you?
Well, you see, Schwartz clearly did not commit any overt acts, so that, you know, wasn't part of. See, Schwartz didn't commit an overt act, which you don't need. But of course, if you're one of the people who commits an overt act in a conspiracy, that's pretty damning evidence. Okay, so poor Bruder, you know, was stuck with his overt acts of outright story changing and lying. You know, and if you tell a story consistently from the beginning, well, then that could be what you believe. You know, things may have been confusing and people perceive what they perceive. But when you mm-hmm. tell one story and then change it, that's a clear, overt act of lying, you know. So Bruder was up the creek with that. And Weiss, it was clear, was a party to that because Bruder wouldn't have said that without Weiss's approval. Mm-hmm. Bringing Schwartz into the conspiracy was more tenuous. And it really revolved around the contact, and this is the most important phone call, the initial contact when the IAB started investigating the case. Schwarz was on patrol with Weiss. They were partners. And they called a body. But it was clear that Schwarz called a body because Schwarz was a body's friend. And so Schwarz initiated the process by which Weiss and Bruder developed their plan to lie. And Schwarz, by making that phone call to a body, made it clear that he would approve an effort to hide his role in the assault on Luima. And according to the law, that's, you know, at least according to the judge's instructions, that's enough for the conspiracy.
So at first, the group of people, in their straw vote, the group of jurors voted to acquit.
Right. But not every. I mean, there was, you know, it was a
mixed majority.
But a majority.
And how did it turn around as you talked? And how long did you deliberate for?
It was Thursday, Friday, then there was a weekend. And we were at the end of what happened was on I think early on, I think we spent most of Thursday figuring out and being sure beyond a reasonable doubt that Schwarz was in the bathroom assisting in the assault on Luima. You know, that was sort of a bedrock that we had to figure out and be unanimous on. And so we even voted on that, not because we had to vote on that, but we wanted to say, okay, we're going to take this as a given and move on from there. So we've spent a lot of time looking at the evidence that placed Schwarz in the bathroom. That's also why I'm so upset about the first trial, because, you know, although we weren't in the first trial and we weren't looking at Schwarz, we went through much of the same evidence that the first trial's jury must have looked at, and it was, you know, in the end, when you put it all together, it was so clear that he was guilty of participating in the assault. So the overturning of the first verdict, of the first trial on Schwarz is really pretty upsetting. But that really took the first day. And then the second day, we really looked at the conspiracy issues and the obstruction of justice acts on the part of Bruder and Weiss. And, you know, there was a lot of pressure. You know, I mean, we felt that we had to figure this out. And
Did the outside weigh inside at all? Were people protesting outside, and were you aware of this?
You know, I don't think I was aware of that. And I'm the kind of person who could join in a protest, not necessarily that, but something. But, you know, when you, at least for me, when I, you know, took that oath as a juror, I was to play it straight, you know, and, you know, if you end up acquitting somebody who you kind of think is guilty, but hey, there is reasonable doubt, then what's great about the American judicial system, I feel, is that it's not all on you. It's the prosecution's job to get that evidence out there and put it before you. And if they don't do it, well, then it's not your fault as a juror that you acquitted somebody. It's the prosecution's fault. And, you know, that's made me actually very sympathetic to juries in general, you know, including some juries where the decision, you know, was one that I, as a distant observer, might, you know, not be happy about.
So Thursday, you talked about whether Schwarz was in the bathroom, and you concluded he was.
That's right.
You even took a vote on it. And then on Friday,
On Friday, we worked on the conspiracy charges, and we had pretty much agreed that Bruder and Weiss were guilty. And then at the end of Friday, a couple of jurors, or no, maybe just one, it was just one, all of a sudden had misgivings, even about Schwarz being in the bathroom. And it was late, and it was getting towards 5. And one thing that was great about the judge was he let us out at 5 or thereabouts always. So so we all left for the weekend thinking, oh, Jesus, we're going to be back to square one on Monday. But, you know, over the weekend, everybody did thinking. Mm-hmm. And when we came in on Monday morning, this person who had started to have misgivings Must have done a lot of thinking and rethinking, which was good. And this person changed their position back. I mean, to recognize that really Schwarz was the, you know, was one of the assailants in the bathroom. And then that morning we were discussing Schwarz. And actually, I was sort of a holdout on Schwarz for a while. You know, just on the technical grounds of proving that he had in some way given agreement in the conspiracy. But it became, you know, if you look at the record, it became pretty obvious.
What most convinced you?
Well, again, the most damning evidence in regard to Schwarz was the phone call to Abadi.
Though you don't know what he said.
But there could only be one reason for Schwarz calling Abadi at that hour in that circumstance.
At what hour?
I think it was 6 a.m. It was really early.
And this was soon after the attack.
This was right. This was as soon as the IAB investigators were in the 7-0 precinct. This was before Volpe had been charged. This was before they found the broomstick. This was before anything. Just as soon as IAB showed up, as soon as IAB showed up to the 7-0, Schwarz flipped out essentially, and the police log shows that Weiss and Schwarz didn't do anything more in their patrol. They were obviously doing a lot of talking, and then they called up Abadi.
So when did you take the vote for conviction of the three police officers?
Well, it was Monday. I mean, you know, the formal vote with all, we had taken straw votes or unofficial votes on Bruder and Weiss on Friday, and we were all clear about that. But of course, we had to take a final vote. I think an official vote, I guess. I think we wrote something down. We checked. I don't even remember. But we did the whatever the official thing was on Monday around 11 o'clock or so.
In the morning.
In the morning, yeah. And that was it. And we came out, and the judge asked what the verdict was, and the forewoman spoke, and then I think he polled everybody, saying, "Do you agree with the verdict?" And you know, you say yes or no, and everybody said yes, and then he said to the marshal, "Get them out of here."
Get them out of here.
Yeah, and it was kind of. It was very rushed and hasty. We didn't have a chance really even to say goodbye to each other, you know. Just we were pushed into the jury room, as often is the case, and they, you know, got the van drivers and the marshals, and we were put onto vans and taken home, and that was that. We never saw each other again. We don't know who we are.
And you felt good about your decision?
Oh, yeah. Yes. I felt very good. I felt... you know, on a human level, I felt bad for Bruder and Weiss because I think they were, you know, human guys who made a real bad mistake. But it was a bad mistake, and you know, they're cops. They're supposed to uphold the law. So their bad mistake was worse than you making a bad mistake like that, or an accountant. You know, they know you're supposed to cooperate with other investigators. They did the opposite. They conspired to obstruct. So I didn't feel bad that they were convicted, and I think they should have done some time.
So what was your reaction? How did you hear this news of the overturning? Were you at work?
I was at work, and I got a call from someone who said, turn on, it's a competitive radio station, but turn on NPR, I confess. And there was the, you know, the news about it, and I was just, you know, amazed. And I also wanted to know more. I mean, I was really upset because I know that they were guilty. I also, you know, my experience makes me feel very strongly that for all its flaws, we have a great justice system, and I know there are really horrible flaws, and it would be great to correct them. But the idea is great, and rule of law is important. And I didn't want to, you know, personally speculate on what that Court of Appeals did until I read about it. And I've read about it, and I think what they did in the case of our trial was terrible, because, you know, the issue of the federal grand jury as opposed to mere federal investigators, that came up in the trial. In fact, on one of the cross-examinations, the U.S. Attorney Vinegrad asked one of the witnesses, well, at that time you knew there was a federal investigation going, or you knew that it was going to be turned over to the feds. And the witness said, yes. And you knew that that would eventually go to a grand jury. And the witness said, yes. And so it was clear that they weren't ignoring that distinction. In the judge's instructions, everywhere it said federal grand jury, federal grand jury, federal grand jury. And we had, and actually in our deliberations, we talked about it very early on. But we didn't talk about it a lot because that was the easiest thing for us. Yeah, they're trying to mislead federal investigators. Well, what for? I mean, the whole point was to obstruct, you know, the process which culminates in the grand jury.
Finally, you didn't want to be identified during this interview.
Right.
Why not?
Well, I'm basically, you know, a number of reasons. One is I'm a private person, and you know, just being identified isn't my style. Two, you know, we got used to being anonymous, and I think that set a tone for how we related to the case, and I still relate to the case, you know, essentially as an anonymous juror. And then three, you know, there's been a sort of a mini movement built around Free Schwarz, and I've looked at their website, and I know about some of the people involved, and some of them are well-meaning, decent, law-abiding people who are just fooled, and others are unsavory characters, and I don't want to deal with them.
You live in the area.
I live in geographic Long Island, somewhere between Orient Point and Red Hook.
Where the jury pool would be drawn from.
Exactly.
And that is the interview with the juror in the second Louima case. That is the Abner Louima conspiracy case. The three officers, Thomas Bruder, Thomas Wies, and Charles Schwarz, were all convicted by the 12 jurors of conspiracy to obstruct justice in the grand jury investigation. A federal appeals court on February 28th overturned those convictions. Now, Charles Schwarz, the only one of the three now in jail, has been released on $1 million bail, and he will go to court in June for a second trial. That does it for today's program. I should add, as you heard this juror say, he was concerned about the, quote, unsavory characters and Officer Schwarz's support committee, so he preferred to remain anonymous. We recorded this interview a few days ago. We did it with him shrouded in darkness, so his face would not be identified. If you'd like to get a copy of today's program, you can call 1-800-735-0230. That's 1-800-735-0230. You can go to our website at democracynow.org. That's democracynow.org. You can email us at mail, M-A-I-L, at democracynow.org. Democracy Now! Is produced by Miranda Kennedy, Lizzie Ratner, Jeremy Scahill, and Chris Abrams. Special thanks today to Karen Renucci and Emily Kunstler. Anthony Sloan is our engineer and music maestro. We are broadcasting from downtown community television, just blocks from where the towers of the World Trade Center once stood. Also thanks to Chase Pearson. I'm Amy Goodman. Thanks for listening to another edition of Democracy Now!
Mr. Police Officer, how can it be that you do what everyone with total impunity? Them bad men, NYPD. Look in the face of that big fat policeman walking down his beat. burning the torches in the precincts and beatings on the streets. Them bad men, NYPD. Richmond's army covering up the badges.